Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Notable.
Hello again to Notable.
Hello.
The podcast. I'm Stuart McConey.
I'm Elizabeth Holker.
And by now, you should know if you've been with us since the beginning that Notable is a podcast where we talk through fascinating, unusual, provocative, earth-shattering stories from the world of music, all kinds of music.
We do, yeah. The whole last 400 years.
At least.
Yeah, at least.
Hey, should we say hello on what will be the last of this first season?
Yeah.
I'm going to use the American term season because I quite like it. This is the season finale.
Okay.
It will be back very soon, by the way, so don't cry. But can we say hello to Turbo-Jugend people all over the world,
yeah,
particularly the Turbo-Jugend Wigan branch, who got in touch with us after our show about Turbo-Jugend.
Yeah.
The global cult.
Here we go. It's Liam Lovett Neal. He's the president of TJ Wigan. And
yeah,
the guy that Stuart saw, that's you, Stuart, but the guy that you saw is the vice president. And he said, really cool to hear us getting mentioned. And he thought we summed them up perfectly, which we're really pleased about.
I was really delighted by that we did them justice. He said we summed them up perfectly. And in case you've not listened to that episode yet, well, you should. But yeah, I saw a young man in the street with a Turbo-Jugend jacket on, and that's what sparked the whole thing. Anyway, hello to Turbo-Jugend Wigan.
He went to St John Fisher Catholic High School. Is that where you
went? I know it very well.
Yeah.
I know it very well.
Okay.
So several people known to me went to that high school.
Yeah. Let's ask no more.
Well, I don't know if we'll have the same effect today. I don't know whether the Bob Dylan fan club or anyone who was at the Rite of Spring in 1913, we'll get in touch. I somehow doubt that. But we're going to talk today about two riots. I predict a riot. Two musical riots.
Yep.
Aren't we?
Yep. Bob Dylan going electric. The hullabaloo that it caused.
Yeah, absolute hullabaloo at the Newport Folk Festival.
Yep.
But I'm going to kick things off by bringing to the party, as it were, the Rite of Spring, the performance thereof, the first performance thereof, of Igor Stravinsky and Diaghilev and Nijinsky's Rite of Spring in 1913 in Paris that caused probably the most sensational opening night in the history of classical music. So, in fact, let's put it another way. I saw one vlogger, if you will, video YouTuber, saying, hey, you know what it's like when sometimes you go to the ballet and you just want to punch someone in the face? Because this isn't your usual ballet activity, is it? There was a riot.
Yeah.
Punches were thrown. Opinions differ and reports differ about exactly what kind of riot it was. But there definitely was a riot. 40 people ejected from the theatre by the police. Fisticuffs, shouting.
Some people feel it's been exaggerated throughout time, don't they? And, you know, any publicity is good publicity.
I suppose in the manner of all pub fights down the years.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean? People say, oh, yeah, it was terrible. They were throwing chairs through the windows and so maybe, you know, maybe it was handbags, to use a classical music term, but it's certainly an interesting story. Igor Stravinsky, young Igor Stravinsky. He's a young lad. His dad is a singer back in Russia, back in the day, a very successful singer. So Igor is brought up both in a very well-to-do household and a musical household, so much so that his dad can afford for him to have none other than Rimsky-Korsakov as his teacher.
Yeah.
So he switches from being a law student to being a music student with Rimsky-Korsakov as his teacher, and he displays a prodigious early talent at this, doesn't he? And soon becomes one of the most notable new talents in music. We're talking about the beginning of the 20th century, where he has a chum called Diaghilev.
Yep.
Diaghilev's talents lie not so much in the playing of music, but in the entrepreneurial field. He is an impresario. And one of the things he does, he sets up a company called Ballet Russe in Paris, where there is a real appetite at this time, the beginning of the 20th century, I beg your pardon, there's a real appetite for all things Russian, and in particular music.
Yeah.
It's seen as exotic and sensual and strange and a little bit savage and a little bit sexy and alluring. So they like their Russian music. So for Diaghilev, Stravinsky composes two ballets, Petrushka and The Firebird, both of which are big hits, both of which take Parisian Musical Society by storm. So Diaghilev says, we'll do another one. And for this one, they turn to Russian pagan folklore, don't they?
They do. And this is what I find quite funny about it, because these people, they looked at the programme and the subject matter isn't for the faint-hearted, is it? And I quite like how classical music audiences throughout the ages, there's some really murky subjects that are dealt with in classical music, but they don't put the audiences off at all. Because it's a pagan ritual, isn't it? And basically a sacrificial virgin dances herself to death.
That old chestnut, the old sacrificial virgin dances herself to death. It is about spring coming to
Tuesday night.
Yes, spring coming to barbaric pre-Christian Russia, and the lifeblood flowing through the spring, through nature, and all these things, and how the priests and the village elders and the young maidens all celebrate this, and particularly one young maiden dances herself to death. That's the story they decided to turn into a ballet score. So Stravinsky goes off to Switzerland, to this tiny Spartan room in Switzerland. I think I have the dimensions here. So he goes to this 8x8 foot chalet, basically, in Switzerland over the winter, the preceding winter, and he writes a version of The Rite of Spring for two pianos.
Yep.
And he plays this to Diaghilev and the conductor and various other people, played in the four hands version with none other than Claude Debussy.
Mm.
It helps if you can get Claude Debussy to help you, I guess, doing the piano playing. Apparently, it was shocking in its piano version state. The conductor, who was going to go on and conduct it, Monteur, said, are you serious?
Yeah.
We're going to put this ballet on, this music. And they said, yeah. And apparently, Diaghilev himself said, as he starts to play it with that dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun that begins the ballet proper, Diaghilev said to Stravinsky, does it go on like this much longer? And Stravinsky said, oh, yes, to the very end, my dear. So they knew. People think Diaghilev knew that it was going to be a bit of a sensation. The pre-publicity was good. And he kind of, I think, talked this up a bit because he was a showman and he was an impresario.
He knew what he was doing. They knew what they were doing, didn't they?
I think they knew what they were doing.
They were ahead of their time, but at the same time, it was enough to create a stir that would interest people rather than it was lost forever. You know, the timing of it was very specific, I think.
Yes. The piano version for two hands, sadly, is lost forever. Yeah. We just know that him and Debussy played it. We don't know what happened to that. But yes, you're right. The timing's important. The pre-publicity was important. And they've got everything's going. It's a perfect storm, really, because they've got this brand new theatre, the Theatre des Champs-Élysées, what they're going to put it on at. The Ballet Russe are a hot ticket. And apparently the audience on that opening night are sort of split in all kinds of ways. Some people think there might have been an element of class struggle in the reception, in that there was high Paris society and the kind of younger, more radical hipsters in the audience, like Debussy and Ravel, who were there representing the artistic community. And you sort of more, you know what I mean, the kind of people we might expect, the sort of aristocratic or bourgeoisie who might go to the Paris theatre because it was the done thing to do, but weren't necessarily the most broad-minded people musically. Anyway, they all pile in. And it begins, famously, the overture with this high strangulated melody in the bassoon, doesn't it? Playing on a bassoon, which had never really played in that higher register.
It's an old
before.
Folk song. It's kind of based on an old folk song, isn't it?
It is. And in the audience that night, the composer Saint-Saëns turns to his neighbour when he hears this and says, what is that instrument? And his neighbour says, it's a bassoon. And he says, if that's a bassoon, I'm a baboon. Bum, bum, bum. Because he was clearly an extremely funny guy.
Pretty sharp.
Pretty sharp for the old quips, but less so about what was going to happen. Anyway, soon after that, as soon as it begins proper, dun, 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 Stravinsky himself said later, immediately the shock, when the curtain goes up and you see the set.
Yeah.
and the costume.
He said a group of knock-kneed and long-braided Lolitas, didn't he?
That's a great phrase. I love that. I had knock-kneed and long-braided Lolitas,
jumping
he said,
up
the dancers.
And down as the storm broke.
You've got to remember that, I'm not saying this in a sort of sleazy way, but ballet, usually, ballerinas, it's very elegant, willowy people with very little on, isn't it? So it's all kind of sensual and beautiful and elegant. The curtain goes up here with these people in tapestries almost and furs, completely covered up, with their arms stuck up and knock-kneed, doing this weird dancing to this dun 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 dun. And almost from the word go, it causes there's a fuss going on in the auditorium. Some people start to shout. Some people start to laugh and jeer and throw things. While down in the pit where the kind of hipsters are, people are cheering. Ravel and Debussy are high-fiving, dancing, maybe.
Doing some impressionistic dancing.
Yeah, and it gets quite out of hand, doesn't it? In that Nijinsky, the choreographer, later to give his name to a successful racehorse, and to Colin Bell, the Manchester City footballer, Nijinsky has to stand on a chair shouting the beats out to the dancers because you can't hear, the dancers can't hear the music over the clamour of the crowd, this competing clamour of people going, this is rubbish, get off, you rubbish, and people going, this is cool, this is the best thing ever. Or words to that effect.
Stravinsky left the auditorium, didn't he, and went and stood in the wings.
He did. He scarpered.
It's the getaway, yeah.
The police were called. 40 people were ejected. They got through it. And apparently there was a kind of standing ovation at the end. Or there was a mixed ovation of stuff. And it, well, was remarkable. It was a remarkable thing. You don't expect that to happen when you go to the ballet. Or do you? Because there's this idea that you said, Elizabeth, there's this idea that Diaghilev and Stravinsky both kind of knew. They put it around. This is going to be savage. This is going to be wild. You're going to be shocked. To kind of stoke up a bit of ferment about it.
They probably invited some people to stir it up a bit as well.
Is that true? I didn't know
well,
that.
Well, perhaps. I don't know. I'm just thinking maybe, that's what might... I would have done. I would have invited Sinead, my friend Sinead.
Your friend Sinead?
Yeah, she would have.
Yes.
She would have stirred it up a bit.
Right. Okay. What's really interesting, I think, one of the interesting things is not long afterwards, they produced just a purely musical version, minus a ballet, an orchestral score that is universally regarded as a masterpiece. So quite quickly, people say, this is incredible. This is changing the face of 20th century music because for the first time, rhythm is coming to the fore. There's dissonance in there. It's complicated, but it's incredibly rhythmic compared to what had gone before. But I think what's interesting is it's a bit like, say, the Sex Pistols, in a way, that if you now listen to, in fact, at the time, but particularly now, if you listen to Anarchy in the UK or God Save the Queen, you think, this is a rock record.
Yeah,
isn't it?
Sounds like a
Do you know
lot
what
of
I
rock
mean?
And roll.
It's
absolutely.
Just quite a loud rock record.
Yeah, yeah.
The sensation about it was sort of contextual, and we've got used to the sound. And in a way, we've got used to the sound of The Rite of Spring. Anybody who goes to the cinema now, watches a horror movie, is used to pumping, dynamic, atonal, savage music.
Yeah.
So you hear it now and you think, yeah, this is pretty groovy.
Yeah, also, I mean, Stravinsky did say, he said something like, this came completely, it was channeled only through my ear or myself, didn't he? He said, you know, like,
right.
This was a completely new harmonic language. And in actual facts, well, we mentioned there's quite the folk song that the bassoon opens
yeah.
with. I think there were 10 or more folk tunes that people have identified that are in the piece. And you mentioned Rimsky-Korsakov as well. There's a lot of textures and harmonies that he used in his music that's
yeah.
present in this. And Glinka as well, shades of his music, and Tchaikovsky. So he was very much building on what had come before
he
in
was.
Russian music.
We should say Russian music was very fashionable in Paris at the time. Borodin, Mussorgsky, Rimsky-Korsakov, all the guys you've mentioned. And so the cause célèbre of it, really, as I say, it's a perfect storm of things going on. But there's no doubt that it is a turning point in Western music. That I don't think music quite this angry and savage and rhythmically propulsive had ever been heard before. But anyway, if you've not heard The Rite of Spring, stick it on. It's a riot.
Yeah.
It's literally a riot. Yeah. Yes. Producer Jeff has suggested to us, and I think he's right, that isn't it in some ways brilliant? I mean, that could happen, that there was a cultural milieu where the opening night of a piece of classical music would have been that much of a sensation.
Everyone wanted to be there.
You wanted to be there. It was
yeah.
a hot ticket. It was a big news story. I mean, as the multiplicity of media and platforms and stuff meant that excitement's gone. Yeah. An opening night can't be that exciting anymore.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. Have you ever been in a crowd that's been rioting about what's going on stage?
I have only once,
and it's a terrible example.
Yeah.
It's the only time was when I saw Daphne and Celeste at the Leeds Festival. But it is famous. They got bottled off, and it was quite unbelievable to watch because they came out full, you know, bounding with energy, and everyone just literally bottled them off the stage. And that's the only time. And I guess probably the organisers did put them on to shock people and to have a little bit, you know, to create a bit of a story.
The Reading Festival in the late 80s, early 90s was notoriously kind of violent and horrible. And I saw Meatloaf get bombarded with bottles of wee by Hell's Angels. Hell's Angels and kind of... But I don't think that was any great artistic objection to Meatloaf. I think it was just the dumb thing, like strawberries and cream at Wimbledon. You threw bottles of urine at Reading.
It was the same for Daphne and Celeste. Poor Daphne and Celeste.
Yeah. I don't know if anybody threw bottles of urine at Diaghilev and Stravinsky. I hope not.
Stone Roses fans in there.
Wow. But also it makes you realise how exciting.
Yeah, absolutely. And in terms of classical music, I can only think of one other example. Michael Tilson Thomas played Steve Reich's four organs at Carnegie Hall in 73. And that caused...
Wow.
They say that was a riot. He threw it in.
Maybe that's a future notable.
Yeah, probably.
Maybe that is a future notable. The other thing before we move off and move on to little Bobby Dylan is... How exciting, this is a personal thing of mine, how exciting was the early 20th century artistically, you know, Picasso, this kind of thing with music, in that so many things were going on. I mean, the First World War is just around the corner, and that brings in a whole new series of stuff. But the sense of excitement of what was happening in literature, you know, modernism. So you've got Joyce and people like that in literature, you've got Picasso in the arts, you've got Stravinsky in music. Just this idea that a new world was being made is really exciting.
It really is. Yes.
Bob Dylan has only had one Billboard number one. Did you know that?
It's astounding, isn't it? It's unbelievable.
Under his own name. It's Murder Most Foul, the 17-minute track from his last album, Rough and Rowdy Ways. And that is his first Billboard number one. A 17-minute single back in the day would never have got to number one, obviously because of radio and because of sales. But obviously now that streaming is involved in that, your clicks count, and Bob gets his first number one under his own name. He's been number one as part of We Are the World and things like that. But Bob Dylan as an artist has only had one number one single, and this
incredible.
Is it.
Incredible. I know. Amazing.
That's our notable exception. Every show we have a one-off. Yep. We do something that's unique. And that leads us on to the second riot.
Yes.
And you're going to tell me about Bobby Dylan at Newport.
Yes.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
So this all really starts at the Newport Festival in 1965, if not even the year before, in 1964. So it's in 1964. Dylan, he's played really successfully in 1963. Then he comes back in 1964. He's introduced on stage by Ronnie Gilbert of the Weavers, who says, "Here he is, take him, you know him, he's yours." Then decades later, Dylan reflects on this in his autobiography, Chronicles. And he says that he failed to sense the ominous forebodings in that introduction. Because basically what Ronnie Gilbert was saying was that the crowd owned him. And that is very much how they felt at the time. You know, he was this spokesperson of a generation who were dismayed by all sorts of things like the rise of capitalism, international capitalism, aggressive foreign policy, these expensive and morally dubious wars abroad. And they saw Bob Dylan as the antidote to this. And I think a lot of the authenticity in his voice and the thing that they related to was in his faithful, as they understood it, interpretations of this folk, you know, back catalogue.
Yes. Because you've got to remember, he's had a couple of big hit albums, hasn't he? He's had Freewheeling and Times They Are Changing, very much in that protest singer
tradition.
Times
They Are Changing.
By 65, you've had a year or two of Beatlemania. And I guess some kids have decided, that's not for me. I want pure Pete Seeger, Woody Guthrie-style political folk. And this dude, Dylan, he's one of us. And then what he effectively is doing when he makes Bringing It All Back Home just before this festival is he's sort of going over to the dark side, isn't he?
Yeah, so he's introducing... I mean, he just wanted to change his sound. He wasn't even abandoning the folk community or you know, the folk style. He was just incorporating electronic instruments into it. And, you know, this, like you say, they just thought that rock and roll was a bit crass and puerile and commercial and that it sold out, become very much part of the machine that they were, you know, opposed to. He did later say, again, reflecting on those comments about being owned by the folk movement, he said, take him as yours, Ronnie Gilbert's comments. He was like, what a crazy thing to say. Screw that. As far as I knew, I didn't belong to anybody then or now. In No Direction Home, he just says, I thought I'd get more power with a small group backing me. It was electric. That doesn't necessarily mean it's modernised just because it's electric.
Yeah.
Country music was electric as well. So he didn't really, he just saw it as like a slight kind of development and progression. He wasn't, you know, completely changing direction. So he comes back, 1965. In March, like you say, we'd had Bringing It All Back Home. Highway 61 Revisited is in the works. It comes out in August, just after July, which is when he appears again at Newport. He takes to the stage with his Fender Strat, begins the set with Maggie's Farm from Highway 61. Immediately, hostility, boos and catcalls, play folk music, people shout, get rid of the band. It escalates throughout the next song, which is Like a Rolling Stone, which I think is just incredible to think now, isn't it? When you consider just how popular and well-loved that song is. By the third song, he's actually driven off stage. It takes a lot to laugh. It takes a train to cry. He has to go off in the middle of that. And apparently backstage, there's a folky confrontation between two kings of the movement, Pete Seeger and Alan Lomax, rush to the sound desk and they're trying to get the power cut. And Peter Yarrow of Peter, Paul and Mary opposes them. So I don't know how he did it. I don't know if there was hurdy-gurdies
thrown
around.
There's all kinds of debate about this. Seeger says, there's the famous story that Seeger had an axe and threatened to cut the cables, didn't he? But then people say, no, this has all got mixed up in that the people who were on before Dylan, or just before Dylan, is the Texas prison singers, which just shows you what an event the Newport Folk Festival was then. So it was a bunch of jailbirds singing songs about, you know, penitentiary life. And they had axes that they thwacked into this tree trunk on stage to provide the rhythm. And Joe Boyd, the great Joe Boyd of Witch Season Records and at Purple Convention and all, Drake. He says, what's happened is people have got all these things mixed up in their mind. The axes, Pete Seeger running around, and it's got conflated into this incident that didn't really happen,
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of that because some people say that people weren't booing Dylan because of the electric instruments. It was just because they couldn't hear and the mix was wrong.
And he didn't play for long enough,
There are all kinds of, there are all kinds of conflicting accounts. And then he apparently returns to the stage with tears in his eyes, although that's, again, you know, possibly not true. And he's with an acoustic guitar and he plays Mr. Tambourine Man and It's All Over Now, Baby Blue. I don't know. Was he confused and upset or was his resolve hardened?
He seems pretty combative about it, doesn't he, all the time?
Shaken.
I mean, he does seem like he's just thinking, the hell with you. He must have known. Because when he comes on, the look,
what
he's got a strat, he's in a leather jacket. Everything about
eyeliner.
Everything about it is designed to make the folkies upset who want the corduroy cap and all that. Everything about it, he's saying, look at me, I'm rock and roll now, isn't it?
Yeah, and he took these people on, didn't he? It just continued. So he continues to write in this way. A year later, he's working with the Hawks, who were later to become the band. May the 16th, 1966, he releases Blonde on Blonde. And the next day, he comes to Manchester. It's literally the next day, May the 17th, for a concert at the Free Trade Hall. This was the 11th date, though, of the European leg on this world tour. And you see it on No Direction Home, don't you? It's all brilliant. The fans of Vox Pops after the shows, and they're like, he's just
playing pop music now. It's rubbish. That's so brilliant, that guy. They're so earnest, these young fans, aren't they?
Yeah. Sheffield and Liverpool, where by all accounts he'd had a much worse time in Liverpool a week or so before.
There's a guy called Keith Butler who's filmed outside the Free Trade Hall, student at Keele. Any pop group could produce better rubbish than that. It's a bloody disgrace. He's a traitor. And then in 1999, in a documentary for the BBC, he was asked what he thought of looking back, and he said, "I just think, you silly young bugger." Which is brilliant.
Well, yeah, because how can you not like a Rolling Stone? I mean, it's just so funny.
Well,
you can see
the guy, he's got a duffel coat, he's got these thick specs on. You can see that these are effectively, like, I wouldn't say the woke people of their day, but they are the earnest, young, politically committed people of their day. They have made an aesthetic decision. They don't want She Loves You, yeah. And they think Dylan's gone to that, hasn't he, and betrayed the cause. Yeah. So, I can see it.
Yeah. So, we know a lot about this concert because, well, Robbie Robertson said that they were recording all these concerts. They were taping them so they could listen back to them, you know, to see what was all the fuss about or what actually happened. He said they would listen to them in their hotel rooms and think, this really isn't as bad as everyone. You know, what is this riot actually about? Yeah. Why is everyone kicking off? So, they had lots of tapes. And, of course, in 1998, the one at the Free Trade Hall was released, Live 1966. The Royal Albert Hall concert is called, isn't it? Because it was misattributed for years and years. That's just how people know it now. So the first half of all these concerts that year, he would start with a bit of an acoustic set. He started with She Belongs to Me, which people objected to because he was singing about himself and singing, you know, about personal struggles instead of the movement. You know, Visions of Johanna. We hear a bit of sort of extra raspiness on the lyrics, The Ghost of Electricity. Mm. Then we hear him, he's starting to play about with songs like Baby Blue. He keeps, you know, he's going at his own pace by this point. He's playing at his own time. Tell Me Mama is on there. There's not a recorded version of that, a studio recorded version of that song, which is a great song. By this point, the band have joined him, and this is where it all starts to kind of kick off. He introduces I Don't Believe You, saying, this is called I Don't Believe You. It used to go like that, and now it goes like this. And we hear some sort of nervous laughter in the crowd, and the band really do tear into it. C.P. Lee.
Manchester music historian, C.P. Lee. He was there, wasn't he?
He was there. Yeah. And he's written about it in his book. He says everyone was taken back by the volume, like being in a jet when it takes off.
Yeah.
It must have seemed really loud then at the time, because I guess was...
Joe Boyd said that about Newport. He said it wasn't as much that people hated what he was playing. It was the sheer volume, which was so much louder than folk gigs, you know.
And the distortion of it. By the time they get to Baby Let Me Follow You Down, hecklers audible by this point, so they disrupt even Dylan's counting. Mm. They're chanting and clapping, so he can barely continue with the concert. He has to break off his intro, actually, and start again. Protest clapping continues. Then he starts to kind of mumble nonsense just to quiet people down, I think, because they're hoping...
Because that's the best way to quiet people down, start mumbling a lot of nonsense.
Because they don't want to miss what he's saying.
Yeah. Oh, yes. I see what you mean,
So he's trying to... But yeah, no, it's a bizarre way to do it. And he says, if only you wouldn't clap so hard. But it's just rowdy by this point. It's kind of like a tussle between the band and the audience. Imagine doing this night after night after night. I think that's the unique thing about this story, isn't it? That it's not just a one-off and then... You know, and also, I suppose, with the Stravinsky example and Steve Reich and the others that we've mentioned, it's not often that the person who is fronting the music has to go out and sort of present this every single night after night after night in front of hundreds of people who are just protesting against it. And I don't know. Yeah. He doesn't seem that disturbed by it, does he, on the film?
I don't think he is. I think he was thinking, bring it on. I want this to happen.
Yeah. Well, he just wanted to break out of that niche. And
he was fed up of being the spokesman for a generation, wasn't he? I mean, one of my favourite Dylan songs, My Back Pages, addresses this directly, doesn't it? Where he sings, but I was so much older then, I'm younger than that now, which is him rejecting the spokesman for a generation tag, saying, I was so het up about things then that I just... Now, just let me play my rock and roll, as it were.
Yeah.
That's a gross oversimplification of what the song's about, but that's a bit to do with it.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's and the famous there's a famous heckle that several people take ownership of, have claimed ownership of, isn't there?
So this is right up to the last song. Like a Rolling Stone is the last song. The crowd's last chance to make a statement, I suppose, and Dylan's. And then there's a quite a tense, quieter moment just before this track starts. And someone very famously shouts, Judas. Which I was thinking, is that the most famous heckle of all time? Probably is.
Possibly.
And what is it that's possibly, so... What is it that's, you know, that people still refer to it, people still talk about it?
It's, which Dylan said himself years later, what a thing to say.
Yeah.
He says basically, that is about the worst thing you could, that's the most hated human being. Well, there's probably quite a few more as hated, but you take his point. He says, this is the man who betrayed Christ to get him crucified. He said, what a thing to say about me. You know?
It's just, it's literally biblical, isn't it?
Yeah, but, and he responds in this odd way, doesn't he?
I don't believe you. He says,
I don't believe you.
You're a liar.
You're lying. You're a liar. You lie. Which is kind of odd. But yeah, but very Dylan. Yeah.
There's another pause. Then he turns to the band. He orders them to play loud.
Yeah.
And they do.
Play it flipping loud.
He does, yeah. And they do. And then it's all over. Dylan says, thank you. And then God Save the Queen comes on over the PA.
Brilliant. Yeah.
So, yeah, the most famous heckle of all time.
Most famous heckle, you might be right. Yeah. Do check out the bit in No Direction Home, though, and D.A. Pennybaker's Don't Look Back, where they interview the kids on the street afterwards, because it is just brilliant, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
These kids are so earnest.
Yeah.
And it's almost charming and a bit irritating, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Why did they go, I wonder? Because they'd heard the music and they knew what was coming, didn't they? That's what I thought when I first saw the film. I was like, why did you all turn up to
do
this?
Do you know what? Here's a thing. Rock music and rock fans, this is something I've long thought. They put it about. They like to think of themselves as being the grooviest, most radical people on earth. Rock fans are the most... and pop fans, the most conservative people in the world. If you don't stick to what they want, I'm reminded of the fuss about the last Arctic Monkeys record, which was a masterpiece.
Yeah.
And I still think is a masterpiece. But because it wasn't all laddish songs about getting in taxis in Sheffield, it was pilloried by both high art critics and lad rockers who said, why is he doing this? Who does he think he is? It's exactly the same. It's don't get ideas with your station.
Yeah, yeah.
Don't change.
Don't change.
We want you to be this.
They don't
we
like
want
change.
You to be like this.
Yeah, yeah.
They don't like change. They're ultra-conservative rock fans, by and large.
Concert tickets are way more expensive now because you can't imagine Arctic Monkeys fans turning up to their shows and booing. For all their bleeding hearts of these 60s folkies.
Yeah, that's true.
They didn't feel bad about, heckling their favourite
artists. As you say, he was coming on. It's quite conciliatory, palliative. He is coming on at first with his acoustic guitar, doing the stuff they like, with some weird songs as well, before he brings the band on. And you do think now, God, lighten up. He just got a band with him, that's all.
Yeah,
But anyway, that's it. That's people. That's music people for you. It's bloody rubbish, pop music.
Best gig of my life, Judas.
Worst gig of my life.
Worst gig of my life, yeah.
If you'd have been there, this is a reference to the... This is a reference, we should say, that when Elizabeth used to do the music news on our afternoon show on Six Music, Elizabeth used to get vox pops of people, and there was always a lad from somewhere like Salford or Bolton or Rochdale who would always go, best gig of my life. So if you'd been there in 1966, it managed you'd got that lad saying, worst gig of my life.
In the end, it just became a thing, didn't it? And then people would say it to me anyway.
But this definitely wasn't that lad, John Cordwell's best gig of his life. It was the worst gig of his life. Of course, you could say that no great musical artist, in pop music or, well, jazz or maybe classical music,
hasn't changed direction.
No truly great artist hasn't at some point had to confront that moment when they change and their audience don't like it. So I guess when Miles Davis goes jazz fusion and people go, you're selling out to rock and roll, or when Brian Wilson wants to expand the vocabulary of the Beach Boys songs and Mike Love of his own band says, you should leave your ego music for your solo albums, mate, or words to that effect, when you made Good Vibrations. I mean, I can remember, when Bowie did Low, some people said, what's this about now? And conversely, when he did Let's Dance, I remember Charles Sharmuri in the NME saying, what's this now? It's got guitars and drum and dance beats all over it. So you can't win. At some point, as you said, people don't, they fear change.
Yeah, but every true artist has to change, don't they? That's the thing.
Certainly been my motto.
Yeah. So next season of Notable,
I mean, it's all going to be Kabuki Theatre.
Who knows how we're going to come back?
It's going to be completely different. It's going to be Morris dancing in Kabuki Theatre.
So watch out, notable purists. Just better brace themselves.
Well, if you were there, it's
Free Trade Hall.
Not likely, but if you were there, or if you knew someone who was there, get in touch with us.
Yeah,
at Notable Podcast on Twitter.
Absolutely.
And it goes without saying, for this, the last of this first season one, it goes without saying, do all those things that we have to ask you to do, like
subscribe,
talk about us, buttonhole people in the Butchers and in Aldi, and say, are you not listening to this?
Share with your
What's the matter with
friends?
You?
Find us on Twitter.
Exactly. Yeah. Best podcast of my life.
We're on Instagram, Twitter, that's right. It.
So that was season one. How was it for you, Elizabeth?
Oh, I have had a great time.
Me
it
too.
Has been the best. It has been the best podcast season of my life.
Well, we're back very soon. Don't be disheartened. Don't feel bereft. We are back very soon with season two of Notable. And to all the people who've supported season one,
thank you.
A very big
and we've
thank
had so
you.
Many lovely comments, haven't we? Obviously, we couldn't possibly
we
read them all out.
And nobody has yet emailed in to say Judy.
They have not. No.
See you soon.
Yeah, see you soon.
Notable, the podcast.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.